April 8, 1928. The day dawned bleak and chill, a moving wall of gray light out of the northeast which, instead of dissolving into moisture, seemed to disintegrate into minute and venomous particles, like dust that, when Dilsey opened the door of the cabin and emerged, needled laterally into her flesh, precipitating not so much a moisture as a substance partaking of the quality of thin, not quite congealed oil. She wore a stiff black straw hat perched upon her turban, and a maroon velvet cape with a border of mangy and anonymous fur above a dress of purple silk. And she stood in the door for a while with her myriad and sunken face lifted to the weather, and one gaunt hand flax-soled as the belly of a fish. Then she moved the cape aside and examined the bosom of her gown. The gown fell gauntly from her shoulders, across her fallen breasts, then tightened upon her paunch and fell again, ballooning a little above the nether garments, which she would remove layer by layer as the spring accomplished and the warm days, in color regal and moribund. She had been a big woman once, but now her skeleton rose, draped loosely in unpadded skin that tightened again upon a paunch almost dropsical, as though muscle and tissue had been courage or fortitude, which the days or the years had consumed, until only the indomitable skeleton was left, rising like a ruin or a landmark above the somnolent and impervious guts. And above that the collapsed face that gave the impression of the bones themselves being outside the flesh, lifted into the driving day with an expression at once fatalistic and of a child's astonished disappointment, until she turned and entered the house again and closed the door. The earth immediately about the door was bare. It had a patina, as though from the soles of bare feet in generations, like old silver or the walls of Mexican houses which have been plastered by hand. Beside the house, shading it in summer, stood three mulberry trees, the fledged leaves that would later be broad and placid as the palms of hands, streaming flatly undulant upon the driving air. A pair of jaybirds came up from nowhere, whirled up on the blast like gaudy scraps of cloth or paper and lodged in the mulberries, where they swung in raucous tilt and recover, screaming into the wind that ripped their harsh cries onward and away like scraps of paper or of cloth in turn. Then three more joined them, and they swung and tilted in the rung branches for a time, screaming. The door of the cabin opened, and Dilsey emerged once more, this time in a man's felt hat and an army overcoat, beneath the frayed skirts of which her blue gingham dress fell in uneven balloonings, streaming too about her as she crossed the yard and mounted the steps to the kitchen door. A moment later she emerged, carrying an open umbrella now, which she slanted ahead into the wind, and crossed to the woodpile and laid the umbrella down, still open. Immediately she caught at it and arrested it and held to it for a while, looking about her. Then she closed it and laid it down and stacked stovewood into her crooked arm, against her breast, and picked up the umbrella and got it open at last and returned to the steps and held the wood precariously balanced while she contrived to close the umbrella, which she propped in the corner just within the door. She dumped the wood into the box behind the stove. Then she removed the overcoat and hat and took a soiled apron down from the wall and put it on and built a fire in the stove. While she was doing so, rattling the great bars and clattering the lids, Mrs. Compson began to call her from the head of the stairs. She wore a dressing gown of quilted black satin, holding it close under her chin. In the other hand she held a red rubber hot water bottle, and she stood at the head of the back stairway, calling Dilsey at steady and inflectionless intervals into the quiet stairwell that descended into complete darkness, then opened again where a gray window fell across it. Dilsey, she called without inflection or emphasis or haste, as though she were not listening for a reply at all. Dilsey. Dilsey answered and ceased clattering the stove, but before she could cross the kitchen Mrs. Compson called her again, and before she crossed the dining room and brought her head into relief against the gray splash of the window, still again. "All right," Dilsey said, "all right, here I is. I'll fill it soon as I get some hot water." She gathered up her skirts and mounted the stairs, wholly blotting the gray light. "Put it down, darn, go on back to bed." I couldn't understand what was the matter. Mrs. Compson said. "I've been lying awake for an hour, at least, without hearing a sound from the kitchen." "You put it down and go on back to bed," Dilsey said. She toiled painfully up the steps, shapeless, breathing heavily. "I'll have the fire gwine in a minute, and the water hot in two mo'."
"I've been lying there for an hour at least," Mrs. Compson said. "I thought maybe you were waiting for me to come down and start the fire."
Dilsey reached the top of the stairs and took the water bottle. "I'll fix it in a minute," she said. "Luster overslept this morning, up half the night at that show. I gwine build the fire myself. Go on now, so you won't wake the others twell I ready."
"If you permit Luster to do things that interfere with his work, you'll have to suffer for it yourself," Mrs. Compson said.
"Jason won't like this if he hears about it. You know he won't."
"'Twasn't none of Jason's money he went on," Dilsey said. "That's one thing, sure."
She went on down the stairs. Mrs. Compson returned to her room. As she got into bed again, she could hear Dilsey yet descending the stairs with a sort of painful and terrific slowness that would have become maddening had it not presently ceased beyond the flapping diminishment of the pantry door. She entered the kitchen and built up the fire and began to prepare breakfast. In the midst of this, she ceased and went to the window and looked out toward her cabin. Then she went to the door and opened it and shouted into the driving weather.
"Luster!"
she shouted, standing to listen, tilting her face from the wind.
"You, Luster!"
She listened. Then, as she prepared to shout again, Luster appeared around the corner of the kitchen.
"Ma'am?"
he said innocently, so innocently that Dilsey looked down at him, for a moment motionless, with something more than mere surprise.
"Whar are you at?" she said.
"Nowhere," he said, "jes in de cellar."
"What you doin' in de cellar?" she said. "Don't stand dar in de rain, fool," she said.
"Ain't doin' nothin'," he said.
He came up the steps.
"Don't you dare come in this door without a armful of wood," she said. "Here I done had to tote your wood and build your fire both. Didn't I tole you not to leave this place last night before that wood box was full to the top?"
"I did," Luster said. "I filled it."
"Whar it gone to den?"
"I don't know, 'em. I ain't touched it."
"Well, you get it full up now," she said, "and get on up there and see about Benji."
She shut the door. Luster went to the woodpile. The five jaybirds whirled over the house, screaming, and into the mulberries again. He watched them. He picked up a rock and threw it.
"Who?" he said. "Get on back to hell where you belong at. 'Tain't Monday yet."
He loaded himself mountainously with stove wood. He could not see over it, and he staggered to the steps and up them and blundered, crashing against the door, shedding billets. Then Dilsey came and opened the door for him, and he blundered across the kitchen.
"You, Luster!" she shouted, but he had already hurled the wood into the box with a thunderous crash.
"Ha!" he said.
"Is you trying to wake up the whole house?"
Dilsey said.
She hit him on the back of his head with the flat of her hand. "Go on up there and get Benji dressed now."
"Yes'm," he said.
He went toward the outer door.
"Why you gwine?" Dilsey said.
"I thought I'd better go round the house and in by the front so I won't wake up Miss Caroline and them."
"You go on up them back stairs like I told you and get Benji's clothes on him," Dilsey said. "Go on now."
"Yes'm,"
Luster said. He returned and left by the dining room door. After a while it ceased to flap. Dilsey prepared to make biscuit. As she ground the sifter steadily above the breadboard, she sang, to herself at first, something without particular tune or words, repetitive, mournful and plaintive, austere, as she ground a faint, steady snowing of flour onto the breadboard. The stove had begun to heat the room and to fill it with murmurous minors of the fire, and presently she was singing louder, as if her voice too had been thawed out by the growing warmth. And then Mrs. Compson called her name again from within the house. Dilsey raised her face as if her eyes could and did penetrate the walls and ceiling, and saw the old woman in her quilted dressing gown at the head of the stairs, calling her name with machine-like regularity.
"Oh, Lord," Dilsey said.
She set the sifter down and swept up the hem of her apron and wiped her hands, and caught up the bottle from the chair on which she had laid it, and gathered her apron about the handle of the kettle, which was now jetting faintly.
"Jess a minute," she called. "The water jest this minute got hot."
It was not the bottle which Mrs. Compson wanted, however, and clutching it by the neck like a dead hen, Dilsey went to the foot of the stairs and looked upward.
"Ain't Luster up dar wid him?"
she said.
"Luster hasn't been in the house. I've been lying here listening for him.
I knew he would be late, but I did hope he'd come in time to keep Benjamin from disturbing Jason on Jason's one day in the week to sleep in the morning.
I don't see how you expect anybody to sleep with you standing in the hall hollering at folks from the crack of dawn,
Dilsey said. She began to mount the stairs, toiling heavily.
I saw that boy up there half an hour ago.
Mrs. Compson watched her, holding the dressing gown under her chin.
What are you going to do? She said.
Going to get Benji dressed and bring him down to the kitchen while he won't wake Jason and Quentin, Dilsey said.
Haven't you started breakfast yet?
I'll tend to that, too, Dilsey said. You better get back in bed till Luster make your fire. Hit cold this morning.
I know it, Mrs. Compson said. My feet are like ice. They were so cold they waked me up.
She watched Dilsey mount the stairs. It took her a long while.
You know how it frets Jason when breakfast is late,
Mrs. Compson said.
I can't do but one thing at a time, Dilsey said. You get on back to bed, for I has you on my hands this morning, too.
If you're going to drop everything to dress Benjamin, I'd better come down and get breakfast. You know as well as I do how Jason acts when it's late.
And who gwine to eat your messin'? Dilsey said. Tell me that.
Go on now, she said, toiling upward. Mrs. Compson stood watching her as she mounted, steadying herself against the wall with one hand, holding her skirts up with the other.
Are you going to wake him up just to dress him? She said.
Dilsey stopped. With her foot lifted to the next step, she stood there, her hand against the wall and the gray splash of the window behind her. Motionless and shapeless, she loomed.
"He ain't awake, then?" she said.
"He wasn't when I looked in," Mrs. Compson said.
"But it's past his time. He never does sleep after 7:30. You know he doesn't."
Dilsey said nothing. She made no further move, but though she could not see her save as a blobby shape without depth, Mrs. Compson knew that she had lowered her face a little, and that she stood now like cows do in the rain, holding the empty water bottle by its neck.
"You're not the one who has to bear it," Mrs. Compson said. "It's not your responsibility. You can go away. You don't have to bear the brunt of it day in and day out. You owe nothing to them, to Mr. Compson's memory. I know you have never had any tenderness for Jason. You've never tried to conceal it."
Dilsey said nothing. She turned slowly and descended, lowering her body from step to step as a small child does, her hand against the wall.
"You go on and let him alone," she said. "Don't go in dar no more now. I'll send Luster up soon as I find him. Let him alone now."
She returned to the kitchen. She looked into the stove, then she drew her apron over her head and donned the overcoat and opened the outer door and looked up and down the yard. The weather drove upon her flesh, harsh and minute, but the scene was empty of all else that moved. She descended the steps gingerly, as if for silence, and went around the corner of the kitchen. As she did so, Luster emerged quickly and innocently from the cellar door. Dilsey stopped.
"What you up to?" she says.
"Nothing," Luster said.
"Mr. Jason say for me to find out why that water leak in the cellar from."
"And when was it he say for you to do that?" Dilsey said.
"Last New Year's Day, wasn't it?"
"I thought I'd just be looking whilst they sleep," Luster said. Dilsey went to the cellar door. He stood aside, and she peered down into the obscurity, odorous of dank earth and mold and rubber.
"Huh," Dilsey said.
She looked at Luster again. He met her gaze blandly, innocent and open.
"I don't know what you up to, but you ain't got no business doing it. You just trying me too this morning, 'cause the others is, ain't you? You get on up dar and see to Benji, you hear?"
"Yes'm," Luster said. He went on toward the kitchen steps, swiftly.
"Here," Dilsey said, "you get me another armful of wood while I got you."
"Yes'm," he said. He passed her on the steps and went to the woodpile. When he blundered again at the door a moment later, again invisible and blind within and beyond his wooden avatar, Dilsey opened the door and guided him across the kitchen with a firm hand.
"Just throw it at that box again," she said. "Just throw it."
"I got to," Luster said, panting.
"I can't put it down no other way."
"Then you stand there and hold it a while," Dilsey said. She unloaded him a stick at a time.
"What got into you this morning?" Here I sent you for wood, and you ain't never bought more than 6 sticks at a time to save your life well today. What you fixin' to ask me can you do now? Ain't that show left town yet?
Yes'm, hit done gone.
She put the last stick into the box.
Now you go on up dar with Benji like I told you before, she said, and I don't want nobody else yellin' down them stairs at me twell I rings the bell. You hear me?
Yes'm, Luster said.
He vanished through the swing door. Dilsey put some more wood in the stove and returned to the breadboard. Presently she began to sing again. The room grew warmer. Soon Dilsey's skin had taken on a rich, lustrous quality as compared with that as of a faint dusting of wood ashes which both it and Luster's had worn as she moved about the kitchen, gathering about her the raw materials of food, coordinating the meal. On the wall above a cupboard, invisible save at night, by lamplight, and even then evincing an enigmatic profundity because it had but one hand, a cabinet clock ticked, then with a preliminary sound as if it had cleared its throat, struck 5 times.
8 o'clock, Dilsey said.
She ceased and tilted her head upward, listening, but there was no sound save the clock and the fire. She opened the oven and looked at the pan of bread. Then stooping, she paused while someone descended the stairs. She heard the feet cross the dining room, then the swing door opened and Luster entered, followed by a big man who appeared to have been shaped of some substance whose particles would not or did not cohere to one another or to the frame which supported it. His skin was dead-looking and hairless. Dropsical, too, he moved with a shambling gait like a trained bear. His hair was pale and fine. It had been brushed smoothly down upon his brow like that of children in daguerreotypes. His eyes were clear, of the pale sweet blue of cornflowers. His thick mouth hung open, drooling a little.
"Is he cold?" Dilsey said.
She wiped her hands on her apron and touched his hand.
"If he ain't, I is," Luster said. "Always cold Easter. Ain't never seen it fail. Miss Caroline say if you ain't got time to fix a hot water bottle to never mind about it."
"Oh, Lord," Dilsey said.
She drew a chair into the corner between the woodbox and the stove. The man went obediently and sat in it.
"Look in the dining room and see where I laid that bottle down," Dilsey said.
Luster fetched the bottle from the dining room, and Dilsey filled it and gave it to him.
"Hurry up now," she said. "See if Jason wake now. Tell him it's all ready."
Luster went out. Ben sat beside the stove. He sat loosely, utterly motionless, save for his head, which made a continual bobbing sort of movement, as he watched Dilsey with his sweet, vague gaze as she moved about. Luster returned.
"He up," he said. "Miss Caroline say put it on the table."
He came to the stove and spread his hands palm down above the firebox.
"He up, too," he said. "Gwine hit with both feet this morning."
"What's the matter now?" Dilsey said.
"Get away from dar. How can I do anything with you standing over the stove?"
"I cold," Luster said.
"You ought to thought about that whilst you was down dar in that cellar," Dilsey said.
"What the matter with Jason?"
"Sayin' me and Benji broke that winder in his room."
"Is day one broke?" Dilsey said.
"That's what he's saying," Luster said.
"Say I broke it."
"How could you when he keep it locked all day and night?"
"Say I broke it chunkin' rocks at it," Luster said.
"And did you?"
"No'm," Luster said.
"Don't lie to me, boy," Dilsey said.
"I never done it," Luster said. "Ask Benji if I did."
"I ain't studying that winder."
"Who could have broke it then?" Dilsey said.
"He just trying hisself to wake Quentin up," she said, taking the pan of biscuits out of the stove.
"Reckon so," Luster said. "These funny folks. Glad I ain't none of 'em."
"Ain't none of who?" Dilsey said.
"Let me tell you something, nigger boy. You got just as much Compson devilment in you as any of 'em. Is you right sure you never broke that window?"
"What I want to break it fur?"
"What do you do any of your devilment fur?" Dilsey said. "Watch him now so he can't burn his hand again twell I get the table set."
She went to the dining room, where they heard her moving about. Then she returned and set a plate at the kitchen table and set food there. Ben watched her, slobbering, making a faint, eager sound.
"All right, honey," she said. "Here your breakfast.
Bring his chair, Luster."
Luster moved the chair up, and Ben sat down, whimpering and slobbering.
Dilsey tied a cloth about his neck and wiped his mouth with the end of it.
"And see can you keep from messing up his clothes one time," she said, handing Luster a spoon.
Ben ceased whimpering. He watched the spoon as it rose to his mouth. It was as if even eagerness were muscle-bound in him, too, and hunger itself inarticulate, not knowing it as hunger. Luster fed him with skill and attachment. Now and then his attention would return long enough to enable him to feint the spoon and cause Ben to close his mouth upon the empty air, but it was apparent that Luster's mind was elsewhere. His other hand lay on the back of the chair, and upon that dead surface it moved, tentatively, delicately, as if he were picking an inaudible tune out of the dead void. And once he even forgot to tease Ben with the spoon while his fingers teased out of the slain wood a soundless and involved arpeggio until Ben recalled him by whimpering again. In the dining room, Dilsey moved back and forth. Presently, she rang a small clear bell, then in the kitchen, Luster heard Mrs. Compson and Jason descending, and Jason's voice, and he rolled his eyes whitely while listening.
"Sure I know they didn't break it," Jason said. "Sure I know that. Maybe the change of weather broke it."
"I don't see how it could have," Mrs. Compson said. "Your room stays locked all day long, just as you leave it when you go to town. None of us ever go in there except Sunday to clean it. I don't want you to think that I would go where I'm not wanted, or that I would permit anyone else to."
"I never said you broke it, did I?" Jason said.
"I don't want to go in your room," Mrs. Compson said. "I respect anybody's private affairs. I wouldn't put my foot over the threshold, even if I had a key."
"Yes," Jason said, "I know your keys won't fit. That's why I had the lock changed. What I want to know is how that window got broken."
"Luster say he didn't do it," Dilsey said.
"I knew that without asking him," Jason said. "Where's Quentin?" he said.
"Where she is every Sunday morning," Dilsey said. "What got into you the last few days, anyhow?"
"Well, we're going to change all that," Jason said. "Go up and tell her breakfast is ready."
"You leave her alone now, Jason," Dilsey said. "She gets up for breakfast every week morning, and Miss Caroline lets her stay in bed every Sunday. You knows that."
"I can't keep a kitchen full of niggers to wait on her pleasure much as I'd like to," Jason said. "Go and tell her to come down to breakfast."
"Ain't nobody have to wait on her," Dilsey said. "I puts her breakfast in the warmer and she—"
"Did you hear me?" Jason said.
"I hears you," Dilsey said.
"All I've been hearing, when you in the house. If it ain't Quentin or your ma, it's Luster and Benji. What you let him go on that way for, Miss Caroline?"
"You better do as he says," Mrs. Compson said. "He's head of the house now. It's his right to require us to respect his wishes. I try to do it, and if I can, you can too.
'Tain't no sense in him being so bad-tempered he got to make Quentin get up just to suit him," Dilsey said. "Maybe you think she broke that window."
"She would if she happened to think of it," Jason said. "You go and do what I told you."
"And I wouldn't blame her none if she did," Dilsey said, going toward the stairs. "Would you nagging at her all the blessed time you in the house?"
"Hush, Dilsey," Mrs. Compson said. "It's neither your place nor mine to tell Jason what to do. Sometimes I think he is wrong, but I try to obey his wishes for you all's sake. If I'm strong enough to come to the table, Quentin can too."
Dilsey went out. They heard her mounting the stairs. They heard her a long while on the stairs.
"You've got a prize set of servants," Jason said.
He helped his mother and himself to food.
"Did you ever have one that was worth killing? You must have had some before I was big enough to remember."
"I have to humor them," Mrs. Compson said. "I have to depend on them so completely. It's not as if I was strong. I wish I were. I wish I could do all the housework myself. I could at least take that much off your shoulders."
"And a fine pigsty we'd live in, too," Jason said.
"Hurry up, Dilsey," he shouted. "I know you blame me," Mrs. Compson said, "for letting them off to go to church today."
"Go where?" Jason said. "Hasn't that damn show left yet?"
"To church," Mrs. Compson said. "The darkies are having a special Easter service. I promised Dilsey 2 weeks ago that they could get off."
"Which means we'll eat cold dinner," Jason said, "or none at all."
"I know it's my fault," Mrs. Compson said. "I know you blame me."
"For what?" Jason said. "You never resurrected Christ, did you?"
They heard Dilsey mount the final stair, then her slow feet overhead.
"Quentin," she said.
When she called the first time, Jason laid his knife and fork down, and he and his mother appeared to wait across the table from one another in identical attitudes.
This book is continued on Disc 7.
They heard Dilsey mount the final stair, then her slow feet overhead. "Quentin," she said. When she called the first time, Jason laid his knife and fork down, and he and his mother appeared to wait across the table from one another in identical attitudes. The one cold and shrewd, with close-thatched brown hair curled into two stubborn hooks, one on either side of his forehead like a bartender in caricature, and hazel eyes with black-ringed irises like marbles. The other cold and querulous, with perfectly white hair and eyes pouched and baffled and so dark as to appear to be all pupil or all iris.
"Quentin," Dilsey said, "get up, honey. They waitin' breakfast on you."
"I can't understand how that window got broken," Mrs. Compson said. "Are you sure it was done yesterday? It could have been like that a long time with the warm weather. The upper sash behind the shade like that."
"I've told you for the last time that it happened yesterday," Jason said. "Don't you reckon I know the room I live in? Do you reckon I could have lived in it a week with a hole in the window you could stick your hand?"
His voice ceased, ebbed, left him staring at his mother with eyes that for an instant were quite empty of anything. It was as though his eyes were holding their breath, while his mother looked at him, her face flaccid and querulous, interminable, clairvoyant yet obtuse. As they sat so, Dilsey said,
"Quentin, don't play with me, honey. Come on to breakfast, honey. They waiting for you."
"I can't understand it," Mrs. Compson said. "It's just as if somebody had tried to break into the house."
Jason sprang up. His chair crashed over backward.
"What?"
Mrs. Compson said, staring at him as he ran past her and went jumping up the stairs where he met Dilsey. His face was now in shadow, and Dilsey said, "She's sullen. Your ma ain't unlocked." But Jason ran on past her and along the corridor to a door. He didn't call. He grasped the knob and tried it, then he stood with the knob in his hand and his head bent a little, as if he were listening to something much further away than the dimensioned room beyond the door, and which he already heard. His attitude was that of one who goes through the motions of listening in order to deceive himself as to what he already hears. Behind him, Mrs. Compson mounted the stairs, calling his name. Then she saw Dilsey, and she quit calling him and began to call Dilsey instead.
"I told you she ain't unlocked that door yet," Dilsey said.
When she spoke, he turned and ran toward her, but his voice was quiet, matter-of-fact. "She carry the key with her," he said. "Has she got it now, I mean, or will she have—"
"Dilsey,"
Mrs. Compson said on the stairs.
"Is which?" Dilsey said. "Why don't you let—"
"The key," Jason said, "to that room. Does she carry it with her all the time?"
"Mother?"
Then he saw Mrs. Compson, and he went down the stairs and met her. "Give me the key," he said. He fell to pawing at the pockets of the rusty black dressing sack she wore. She resisted.
"Jason," she said, "Jason, are you and Dilsey trying to put me to bed again?" she said, trying to fend him off. "Can't you even let me have Sunday in peace?"
"The key," Jason said, pawing at her. "Give it here."
He looked back at the door as if he expected it to fly open before he could get back to it with the key he did not yet have.
"You, Dilsey," Mrs. Compson said, clutching her sack about her. "Give me the key, you old fool," Jason cried suddenly.
From her pocket he tugged a huge bunch of rusted keys on an iron ring like a medieval jailer's, and ran back up the hall with the two women behind him.
"You, Jason," Mrs. Compson said.
"He will never find the right one," she said. "You know I never let anyone take my keys, Dilsey," she said.
She began to wail.
"Hush," Dilsey said. "He ain't gwine to do nothing to her. I ain't gwine let him."
"But on Sunday morning in my own house," Mrs. Compson said, "when I've tried so hard to raise them Christians—"
"Let me find the right key, Jason," she said.
She put her hand on his arm. Then she began to struggle with him, but he flung her aside with a motion of his elbow and looked around at her for a moment, his eyes cold and harried. Then he turned to the door again and the unwieldy keys.
"Hush," Dilsey said. "You, Jason—"
"Something terrible has happened," Mrs. Compson said, wailing again. "I know it has. You, Jason," she said, grasping at him again. "He won't even let me find the key to a room in my own house."
"Now, now," Dilsey said, "what can happen? I right here. I ain't gwine let him hurt her. Quentin," she said, raising her voice. "Don't you be scared, honey. I's right here."
The door opened, swung inward. He stood in it for a moment, hiding the room, then he stepped aside. "Go in," he said in a thick, light voice. They went in. It was not a girl's room. It was not anybody's room. And the faint scent of cheap cosmetics and the few feminine objects and the other evidences of crude and hopeless efforts to feminize it, but added to its anonymity, giving it that dead and stereotyped transience of rooms in assignation houses. The bed had not been disturbed. On the floor lay a soiled undergarment of cheap silk, a little too pink. From a half-opened bureau drawer dangled a single stocking. The window was open. A pear tree grew there, close against the house. It was in bloom, and the branches scraped and rasped against the house, and the myriad air, driving in the window, brought into the room the forlorn scent of the blossoms. "Dar now," Dilsey said. "Didn't I told you she all right?"
"All right," Mrs. Compson said.
Dilsey followed her into the room and touched her.
"You come on and lay down now," she said. "I find her in 10 minutes.
Mrs. Compson shook her off.
"Find the note," she said. "Quentin left a note when he did it."
"All right," Dilsey said. "I'll find it. You come on to your room now."
"I knew the minute they named her Quentin this would happen," Mrs. Compson said.
She went to the bureau and began to turn over the scattered objects there. Scent bottles, a box of powder, a chewed pencil, a pair of scissors with one broken blade lying upon a darned scarf dusted with powder and stained with rouge.
"Find the note," she said.
"I is," Dilsey said. "You come on now. Me and Jason'll find it. You come on to your room."
"Jason," Mrs. Compson said.
"Where is he?"
She went to the door. Dilsey followed her on down the hall to another door. It was closed.
"Jason,"
she called through the door. There was no answer. She tried the knob, then she called him again. But there was still no answer, for he was hurling things backward out of the closet, garments, shoes, a suitcase. Then he emerged, carrying a sawn section of tongue-and-groove planking, and laid it down, and entered the closet again and emerged with a metal box. He set it on the bed, and stood looking at the broken lock while he dug a key ring from his pocket and selected a key. And for a time longer he stood with the selected key in his hand, looking at the broken lock. Then he put the keys back in his pocket and carefully tilted the contents of the box out upon the bed. Still carefully he sorted the papers, taking them up one at a time and shaking them. Then he upended the box and shook it too, and slowly replaced the papers, and stood again, looking at the broken lock, with the box in his hands and his head bent. Outside the window he heard some jaybirds swirl, shrieking, past and away, their cries whipping away along the wind, and an automobile passed somewhere and died away also. His mother spoke his name again beyond the door, but he didn't move. He heard Dilsey lead her away up the hall, and then a door closed. Then he replaced the box in the closet and flung the garments back into it, and went downstairs to the telephone. While he stood there with the receiver to his ear waiting, Dilsey came down the stairs. She looked at him, without stopping, and went on. The wire opened.
"This is Jason Compson," he said, his voice so harsh and thick that he had to repeat himself. "Jason Compson," he said, controlling his voice. "Have a car ready with a deputy if you can't go in 10 minutes. I'll be there."
"What?"
"Robbery. My house. I know who it—"
"Robbery, I say. Have a car ready—"
"What? Aren't you a paid law enforcement—"
"Yes, I'll be there in 5 minutes. Have that car ready to leave at once. If you don't, I'll report it to the governor."
He clapped the receiver back and crossed the dining room, where the scarce broken meal lay cold now on the table, and entered the kitchen. Dilsey was filling the hot water bottle. Ben sat, tranquil and empty. Beside him, Luster looked like a feist dog, brightly watchful. He was eating something. Jason went on across the kitchen.
"Ain't you gonna eat no breakfast?"
Dilsey said. He paid her no attention.
"Go on in and eat your breakfast, Jason."
He went on. The outer door banged behind him. Luster rose and went to the window and looked out.
"Whew," he said. "What happening up dar? He been beating Miss Quentin?"
"You hush your mouth," Dilsey said. "You get Benji started now and I beat your head off. You keep him quiet as you can twell I get back now."
She screwed the cap on the bottle and went out. They heard her go up the stairs, then they heard Jason pass the house in his car. There was no sound in the kitchen save the simmering murmur of the kettle and the clock.
"You know what I bet?" Luster said. "I bet he beat her. I bet he knock her in the head, and now he gone for the doctor. That's what I bet."
The clock tick-tocked, solemn and profound. It might have been the dry pulse of the decaying house itself. After a while it whirred and cleared its throat and struck 6 times. Ben looked up at it. Then he looked at the bullet-like silhouette of Luster's head in the window, and he began to bob his head again, drooling. He whimpered.
"Hush up, loony," Luster said without turning. "Look like we ain't gwine to get to go to no church today."
But Ben sat in the chair, his big soft hands dangling between his knees, moaning faintly. Suddenly he wept, a slow bellowing sound, meaningless and sustained.
"Hush," Luster said.
He turned and lifted his hand.
"You want me to whoop you?"
But Ben looked at him, bellowing slowly with each expiration. Luster came and shook him.
"You hush this minute," he shouted. "Here," he said.
He hauled Ben out of the chair and dragged the chair around facing the stove and opened the door to the firebox and shoved Ben into the chair. They looked like a tug nudging at a clumsy tanker in a narrow dock. Ben sat down again, facing the rosy door. He hushed. Then they heard the clock again and Dilsey slow on the stairs. When she entered, he began to whimper again. Then he lifted his voice.
"What you done to him?" Dilsey said. "Why can't you let him alone this morning of all times?"
"I ain't done nothing to him," Luster said. "Mr. Jason skeered him. That's what it is. He ain't killed Miss Quentin, is he?"
"Hush, Benji," Dilsey said.
He hushed. She went to the window and looked out.
"Is it quit rainin'?" she said.
"Yes'm," Luster said.
"Quit long time ago."
"Then you all go outdoors a while," she said. "I just got Miss Caroline quiet now."
"Is we gwine to church?" Luster said.
"I'll let you know about that when the time come. You keep him away from the house twell I calls you."
"Can we go to the pasture?" Luster said.
"All right, only you keep him away from the house. I done stood all I can."
"Yes'm," Luster said.
"Why Mr. Jason gone, mammy?"
"That's some all your business, ain't it?"
Dilsey said. She began to clear the table.
"Hush, Benji. Luster gwine take you out to play."
"What he done to Miss Quentin, mammy?"
Luster said.
"Ain't done nothing to her. You all get on out in here."
"I bet she ain't here," Luster said.
Dilsey looked at him.
"How you know she ain't here?"
"Me and Benji seed her climb out the window last night. Didn't us, Benji?"
"You did," Dilsey said, looking at him.
"We sees her doing it every night," Luster said. "Climb right down that pear tree."
"Don't you lie to me, nigger boy," Dilsey said.
"I ain't lying. Ask Benji if I is."
"Why don't you say something about it, then?"
"'Twan't none of my business," Luster said.
"I ain't gwine to get mixed up in white folks' business.
Come on here, Benji. Let's go outdoors."
They went out. Dilsey stood for a while at the table. Then she went and cleared the breakfast things from the dining room and ate her breakfast and cleaned up the kitchen. Then she removed her apron and hung it up and went to the foot of the stairs and listened for a moment. There was no sound. She donned the overcoat and the hat and went across to her cabin. The rain had stopped. The air now drove out of the southeast, broken overhead into blue patches. Upon the crest of a hill beyond the trees and roofs and spires of town, sunlight lay like a pale scrap of cloth, was blotted away. Upon the air a bell came, then, as if at a signal, other bells took up the sound and repeated it. The cabin door opened and Dilsey emerged, again in the maroon cape and the purple gown, and wearing soiled white elbow-length gloves and minus her headcloth now. She came into the yard and called Luster. She waited a while, then she went to the house and around it to the cellar door, moving close to the wall, and looked into the door. Ben sat on the steps. Before him Luster squatted on the damp floor. He held a saw in his left hand. The blade sprung a little by pressure of his hand, and he was in the act of striking the blade with the worn wooden mallet with which she had been making beaten biscuit for more than 30 years. The saw gave forth a single sluggish twang that ceased with lifeless alacrity, leaving the blade in a thin, clean curve between Luster's hand and the floor. Still, inscrutable, it bellied.
"That's the way he done it," Luster said. "I just ain't found the right thing to hit it with."
"That's what you doin', is it?" Dilsey said. "Bring me dat mallet," she said.
"I ain't heard it," Luster said.
"Bring it here," Dilsey said.
"Put that saw where you got it first."
He put the saw away and brought the mallet to her. Then Ben wailed again, hopeless and prolonged. It was nothing, just sound. It might have been all time and injustice and sorrow become vocal for an instant by a conjunction of planets.
"Listen at him," Luster said. "He been gwine on that way ever since you sent us out in the house. I don't know what got into him this morning."
"Bring him here," Dilsey said.
"Come on, Benji," Luster said.
He went back down the steps and took Ben's arm. He came obediently, wailing, that slow, hoarse sound that ships make, that seems to begin before the sound itself has started, seems to cease before the sound itself has stopped.
"Run and get his cap," Dilsey said. "Don't make no noise Miss Caroline can hear. Hurry now, we already late."
"She gwine hear him anyhow if you don't stop him," Luster said.
"He stop when we get off the place," Dilsey said. "He's smelling it, that's what it is."
"Smell what, Mammy?"
Luster said.
"You go get that cap," Dilsey said.
Luster went on. They stood in the cellar door, Ben one step below her. The sky was broken now into scudding patches that dragged their swift shadows up out of the shabby garden, over the broken fence, and across the yard. Dilsey stroked Ben's head, slowly and steadily, smoothing the bang upon his brow. He wailed quietly, unhurriedly.
"Hush," Dilsey said. "Hush now, we be gone in a minute. Hush now."
He wailed quietly and steadily. Luster returned, wearing a stiff new straw hat with a colored band and carrying a cloth cap. The hat seemed to isolate Luster's skull, in the beholder's eye as a spotlight would, in all its individual planes and angles. So peculiarly individual was its shape that at first glance the hat appeared to be on the head of someone standing immediately behind Luster. Dilsey looked at the hat.
"Why don't you wear your old hat?" she said.
"Couldn't find it," Luster said.
"I bet you couldn't. I bet you fixed it last night so you couldn't find it. You fixin' to ruin dat un."
"Oh, Mammy," Luster said, "it ain't gwine rain."
"How you know? You go get that old hat and put that new one away."
"Oh, Mammy."
"Then you go get the umbrella."
"Oh, Mammy."
"Take your choice," Dilsey said. "Get your old hat or the umbrella. I don't care which."
Luster went to the cabin. Ben wailed quietly.
"Come on," Dilsey said. "They can catch up with us. We gwine to hear the singin'."
They went around the house, toward the gate.
"Hush," Dilsey said from time to time, as they went down the drive.
They reached the gate. Dilsey opened it. Luster was coming down the drive behind them, carrying the umbrella. A woman was with him.
"Here they come," Dilsey said.
They passed out the gate. "Now then," she said. Ben ceased. Luster and his mother overtook them. Phrony wore a dress of bright blue silk and a flowered hat. She was a thin woman with a flat, pleasant face.
"You got 6 weeks' work right down your back," Dilsey said. "What you gwine do if it rain?"
"Get wet, I reckon," Phrony said. "I ain't never stopped no rain yet."
"Mammy always talking about he'd gwine rain," Luster said.
"If I don't worry about y'all, I don't know who is," Dilsey said. "Come on, we already late."
"Reverend Shegar gwine preach today," Phrony said.
"Is," Dilsey said. "Who him?"
"He from St. Louis," Phrony said. "That big preacher."
"Huh," Dilsey said. "What they needs is a man can put the fear of God into these here trifling young niggers."
"Reverend Shegar can do that," Phrony said. "So they tells."
They went on along the street. Along its quiet length, white people in bright clumps moved churchward, under the windy bells, walking now and then in the random and tentative sun. The wind was gusty, out of the southeast, chill and raw after the warm days.
"I wish you wouldn't keep on bringing him to church, Mammy,"
Phrony said. "Folks talking."
"What folks?" Dilsey said.
"I hears 'em," Phrony said.
"And I knows what kind of folks," Dilsey said. "Trash white folks, that's who it is. thinks he ain't good enough for white church, but nigger church ain't good enough for him.
They talks just the same, Phrony said.
Then you send him to me, Dilsey said. Tell him the good Lord don't care whether he bright or not. Don't nobody but white trash care that.
A street turned off at right angles, descending, and became a dirt road. On either hand, the land dropped more sharply. A broad flat dotted with small cabins whose weathered roofs were on a level with the crown of the road. They were set in small grassless plots littered with broken things, bricks, planks, crockery, things of a once utilitarian value. What growth there was consisted of rank weeds, and the trees were mulberries and locusts and sycamores, trees that partook also of the foul desiccation which surrounded the houses, trees whose very burgeoning seemed to be the sad and stubborn remnant of September, as if even spring had passed them by, leaving them to feed upon the rich and unmistakable smell of negroes in which they grew. From the doors negroes spoke to them as they passed, to Dilsey usually.
"Sis Gibson, how you dis mornin'?"
"I'm well, is you well?"
"I'm right well, I thank you."
They emerged from the cabins and struggled up the shaling levee to the road. Men in staid, hard brown or black, with gold watch chains and now and then a stick. Young men in cheap violent blues or stripes and swaggering hats. Women a little stiffly sibilant, and children in garments bought second-hand of white people, who looked at Ben with the covertness of nocturnal animals.
"I bet you won't go up and tetch him."
"How come I won't?"
"I bet you won't. I bet you scared to."
"He won't hurt folks. He does a loony."
"How come a loony won't hurt folks?"
"Dadden won't. I tetched him."
"I bet you won't now."
"Case Miss Dilsey lookin'."
"You won't no ways. He don't hurt folks. He des a loony."
And steadily the older people, speaking to Dilsey, though unless they were quite old, Dilsey permitted Phrony to respond.
"Mammy ain't feelin' well this mornin'."
"That's too bad, but Reverend Shegog'll cure that. He'll give her the comfort and the unburdenin'."
The road rose again to a scene like a painted backdrop. Notched into a cut of red clay crowned with oaks, the road appeared to stop short off, like a cut ribbon. Beside it, a weathered church lifted its crazy steeple like a painted church, and the whole scene was as flat and without perspective as a painted cardboard set upon the ultimate edge of the flat earth, against the windy sunlight of space and April and a mid-morning filled with bells. Toward the church they thronged with slow Sabbath deliberation. The women and children went on in. The men stopped outside and talked in quiet groups until the bell ceased ringing. Then they too entered. The church had been decorated, with sparse flowers from kitchen gardens and hedgerows, and with streamers of colored crepe paper. Above the pulpit hung a battered Christmas bell, the accordion sort that collapses. The pulpit was empty, though the choir was already in place, fanning themselves, although it was not warm. Most of the women were gathered on one side of the room. They were talking. Then the bell struck one time, and they dispersed to their seats, and the congregation sat for an instant, expectant. The bell struck again one time. The choir rose and began to sing, and the congregation turned its head as one, as six small children, four girls with tight pigtails bound with small scraps of cloth like butterflies, and two boys with close-napped heads, entered and marched up the aisle, strung together in a harness of white ribbons and flowers, and followed by two men in single file. The second man was huge, of a light coffee color, imposing in a frock coat and white tie. His head was magisterial and profound, his neck rolled above his collar in rich folds. But he was familiar to them, and so the heads were still reverted when he had passed, and it was not until the choir ceased singing that they realized that the visiting clergyman had already entered, and when they saw the man who had preceded their minister enter the pulpit still ahead of him, an indescribable sound went up, a sigh, a sound of astonishment and disappointment. The visitor was undersized, in a shabby alpaca coat. He had a wizened black face like a small-aged monkey, and all the while that the choir sang again, and while the six children rose and sang in thin, frightened, tuneless whispers, they watched the insignificant-looking man sitting dwarfed and countrified by the minister's imposing bulk, with something like consternation. They were still looking at him with consternation and unbelief when the minister rose and introduced him in rich rolling tones, whose very unction served to increase the visitor's insignificance.
"And they brung dat all the way from St. Louis?" Frony whispered. "I've knowed the Lord to use queerer tools than that," Dilsey said. "Hush now," she said to Ben. "They fixin' to sing again in a minute."